This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The guiding principle behind most TV is that viewers have short attention spans. But that principle doesn't guide the people at C-SPAN. They give us gavel-to-gavel coverage of our Congress and Senate, whether the sessions are lively or dull. C-SPAN also brings us hearings, debates, and symposia on public policy, roundtable discussions, and call-in shows. It's enabled us to watch our government at work, at its best and worst. C-SPAN doesn't have to worry about ratings. It's nonprofit, funded as a public service by America's cable companies. My guest Brian Lamb is the founder and CEO of C-SPAN, but C-SPAN viewers know him as a host who does interviews and takes listener calls. His mission is to bring us events in their entirety. No editing, no commentary. He even wants the camera to watch with a neutral eye.
We try very hard not to try to influence the audience with the way the camera angles are positioned or with the tightness of the shot. The best way to describe that, anybody that's ever watched 60 Minutes knows that they use special camera angles to help create a drama in the whole program. That's something that we would never do, at least we would knowingly never do it, because we want you to see the person or the individual exactly the way you would if you're sitting in a room with them. You wouldn't get up tight on their eyes or on their mouth. You would have a, you know, just a natural conversation. So if you go back to the conventions, you will, and you examined our coverage, there was a lot of effort made at not trying to artificially portray what was going on in the hall.
Let's talk a little bit about the creation of C-SPAN. You started proposing the idea of a cable network that would cover Congress back in 1977. Tell us how you got the initial idea for this.
Well, it was kind of an evolving thing. I came to Washington for the first time back in 1966 when I was in the United States Navy. And I was assigned to the Pentagon as a public affairs officer that literally every day dealt with requests from the commercial networks to cover different events. I mean, an example, at the time the Secretary of Defense was Robert McNamara, and if one of the networks wanted to interview him, they might call our department and I might get the call and I might have to, what they called it those days, staffing it. So I got very interesting exposure to how the whole system worked. And in 1966, I was 25 years old, and it was kind of my real, I mean, it's my first real education on how the system worked. The longer I was around it, the more I saw that a lot of what ended up on the evening news was not what happened that day.
Can you give me an example of something that you watched on the evening news and said, that's not what happened?
I'll give you a great example. And I was talking about this yesterday with somebody that was interested in this process at the office. And there was a correspondent by the name of Bill Downs, who's no longer alive. He used to work at CBS. He was in the Eric Severide group years ago. And then he eventually was hired by ABC, and he was assigned to the Pentagon. When I was there in 1966, Bill Downs was the Pentagon correspondent for ABC. That was right in the middle of the Vietnam War and the buildup in 66 and 67. And I remember a group of young people coming down from Volantown, Connecticut, about 40 of them, marching against the war, coming to the Pentagon. They were going to disrupt the war machine, and they marched on the Pentagon, and they were allowed to come in, and they camped out in front of the war room where the Joint Chiefs of Staff met. And Bill Downs one afternoon, and I was assigned to be the, you know, the communications officer to go with him down to do his piece. And so he stood up in the middle of these young people. Up until that point, they had been lying on the floor, very peaceful, very pleasant human beings, had a strong message to deliver, and it was a pacifist message that the war was wrong. There's nothing wrong with any of that. That's part of our system. But the minute that the cameras rolled for ABC and that Bill Downs stood up, all of these young people stood up, took their placards, and started screaming, stop the war, stop the war. And so Bill Downs is shouting to the camera, you know, this is Bill Downs in the middle of all these young people outside the war room at the Pentagon for ABC News. There was nothing that the audience saw in that report that was an accurate account of how those young people had been operating. And that was one of many things that I saw when I was in the Pentagon that told me that there was just something a little bit askew here and that the audience ought to see the whole thing and make up their own mind as to what is right and what is wrong.
So all this manipulation that you were seeing of the press, manipulation by the press, led you to think that there needed to be a place on TV where events would be as they were, real, unedited.
Yeah. I would also add to that, and it kind of evolved again. My first try at this didn't work. The cable industry wasn't interested when the first pitch was made of having just another channel full of meet the press type programs. That was in the early days. CNN had not even been announced that it was going to happen, and there were only about four channels on the satellite. HBO was one of them. Channel 17 out of Atlanta was another. And it dawned on me at that point that maybe the industry might be interested in televising the U.S. House of Representatives. Because the House had been discussing that possibility for about 6 years and never quite could make a decision. And so we married the two. The industry said, that's a good idea. Let's do it. We can afford to do that. And the House of Representatives said, gee, that would be interesting if the audience could see it all. The nice thing about it was we were able to start by creating a television pipeline for our elected representatives in a democracy to be heard by their constituents. And that seemed to me that's probably why we've been able to succeed, is that was the right way to begin instead of just television in general and more programs like This Week with David Brinkley.
So when you first started televising Congress, and this was back in 1979, what were some of the debates in-house and the debates with Congress about how to televise it? Where should the cameras be? Who should control the cameras?
Well, one of the most disappointing aspects of our association with the Congress, I think, over the years has been that they have had such tight control over the cameras. It's probably as tight a control as any country in the world. It doesn't track with what our democracy is all about, and I've never quite understood why they were so concerned about the coverage. But the Speaker of the House has total control over who will be televised and basically photographed at any one point. And there have been some controversies over that. As a matter of fact, Tip O'Neill years ago, turned the cameras on the whole chamber to show during special orders that there wasn't anybody there. If I had anything to say about it, and I do not, and I've never tried to have anything to say about it, I would, we would put our own cameras in there and we would show the chambers reflecting exactly what's there during the time of day when they're actually having legislative debate. So we really stay away from the operation of the House and its television facility. That's their business. We try to tell the audience often enough so that they know that they're controlling the cameras, so they don't think that we're doing it. That will probably not change for a long time.
Why not? Don't you have enough clout now to say, listen, you guys, you really want to be on C-SPAN now. You've seen the effects it has. So now we're going to insist that we control the cameras.
We don't have enough clout, don't have any clout with them when it comes to that. And as a matter of fact, the only people that have clout, and this is probably the way it ought to be, is the people. And if the public at large gets mad enough about anything that they see in the Congress, they can have a major impact. And probably the most recent example of that was the Zoe Baird nomination.
What would you do differently if you were controlling how Congress was televised?
Well, if we were allowed to put our own cameras in there, we would just show the facility as it is. We would show reaction shots. The only people that are allowed to be shown on camera are those speaking. In the British House of Commons, they think they have the toughest laws in the world about what can be seen. But one of the laws, one of the regulations in the British House of Commons is that they can show reaction shots. If somebody is addressing another member of the parliament, the camera can pick that other member up to see what kind of face they're making. You can't even do that in the House of Representatives. And what I think they ought to do, both in the House and the Senate, and again, they don't ask me, and they're not about to ask me, but if they ever did, is that they ought to show it as it is.
Now, did it take a longer time to convince the Senate? You didn't start broadcasting the Senate till 1986. Was that because of money or because they weren't interested?
Well, we didn't convince the Senate. The Senate convinced itself. And the way that worked was in 1981, when Howard Baker was majority leader, he put a piece of legislation into the hopper. I believe it was Senate Resolution 20, if I can remember right, that would have opened the Senate to television. And for a lot of reasons, he was not successful during his tenure as majority leader in getting the Senate to go on television. Some people suspected that he was running for president and that that was his way of getting attention, through the cameras. But really what happened in the end was Senator Russell Long was one of the great opponents of televising the Senate, and so was Senator Robert Byrd. And back in about 1985 or so, Senator Byrd started to, and this is what he told me, he started to hear when he would go back home to West Virginia that people were confusing him with Speaker Tip O'Neill because they both had white hair. And they saw Tip O'Neill on television a lot. And I think what really did it for Senator Byrd was the day he got introduced as this, the Speaker of the House, Bob Byrd, at some function. At least that's what he told me. And he decided that if the Senate was going to be the institution that he thought it was, and that it was the world's most deliberative body and the world's most important debating organization, that the Senate better go on television. He convinced Senator Russell Long to step aside. He led the charge in the Senate, and when he did that and dropped his opposition, it was passed.
I know there was one story, and this goes back a few years, I think. You actually referred to this in an earlier answer, where the camera was on, I think, a Republican who was speaking after everybody else had gone home, basically.
Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, and whoever was running the camera pulled back and showed the empty seats. Can you actually tell us that story?
Sure. What happened was this was back in the mid-'80s, and the Republicans, in the name of Congressman Newt Gingrich and Bob Walker and Dan Lundgren and I think Van Weber might have been there, although he didn't do much of that, would get on the floor of the House of Representatives after the legislative business was completed during what they call special orders, where any member can get an hour and say anything they want to say. And they were getting up day after day being very critical of the other side, naming people. Congressman Ed Bolin was one that they would name, and Tip O'Neill and others. And Tip O'Neill got tired of them speaking to an empty chamber and gesturing to the room as if there were people there. And he would say this. I don't say this. This is what he said, is that they would look over to the Democratic side of the aisle and act like there were people there and then say, it's your turn to come respond to what I'm saying about you, and no one would ever respond. So one day he literally ordered the cameras to swing to the chamber without any warning to the Republicans to show that there was no one in the chamber but Newt Gingrich at the microphone. Actually, I'm trying to remember whether it was Newt Gingrich or Bob Walker. I think Bob Walker was at the microphone because somebody came and slipped a note to him and said, they've just turned the cameras on this chamber and to show that there's nobody here. And that Tom Reed of the Washington Post was watching the whole thing, and he went to the typewriter and created what he called Cam Scam and made a big thing out of it. And for a lot of people in Washington, D.C., especially the Washington Post, this is the first time I ever heard of C-SPAN. This is about 5 years into our existence. And they made a big deal out of it. It ran for days on the front page with pictures and everything else, calling this whole thing Cam Scam. And the speaker never backed down. They still show only, though, during special orders, that the chamber and who's in there. Unfortunately, they do not show during the actual meaty legislative business day who's in there and who isn't.
Does the majority party control the camera?
Yes. The Speaker of the House in the House of Representatives controls the camera, has absolute say-so over which direction they're pointed in. In the United States Senate, it's the Rules Committee, and the chairman of the Rules Committee is Wendell Ford.
Well, Brian Lamb, I think it's time to take a little break. So let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Brian Lamb, the founder of C-SPAN, and you also know him as a program host on C-SPAN. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Brian Lamb, you're the founder of C-SPAN and the CEO. How did you decide to put yourself on the air? You're one of the people who we often see on the air doing interviews or taking phone calls, doing continuity between broadcasts.
I was cheap.
Yeah.
I was real cheap. Still am cheap. In the early days, there were only, when I went on the air first, I think there were 7 people that worked at C-SPAN. I mean, we'd take a couple cameras up to the hill and cover a hearing in the daytime, run them back to the studio. Actually, it was one big office where I sat in, and one of my helpers, Janet Dabrowski, sat in. We all sat in one room. We cleared the desks off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We fired up the cameras. We opened them up and took calls, telephone calls, in 1980. October 7th was our first day, from the audience on our business lines. So sometimes we get a call from somebody that wanted to do business with us during the middle of a call-in show, and they found themselves on the air talking to us about issues. So in those very early days, and frankly, the only people that were paying attention, because no one in Washington could see us in those early days, were just common, ordinary, down-to-earth folks out there that knew everything that was going on, loved the fact that they were there in the early days, and didn't have any pretense or worry about whether or not we were sophisticated.
So, okay, so you put yourself on the air because you were cheap, you said. But I think your policy is basically not to hire on-air people, but to use people from behind the scenes.
We have about 7 people now that go on the air.
Mm-hmm.
All but 2 of them work full-time at C-SPAN. 2 of them do part-time work for us, fill in when we have problems. Everybody else has a major job. Susan Swain, who's on the air, is our senior vice president and co-chief operating officer. Bruce Collins is our general counsel. Lou Ketchum and Steve Scully and Kathy Buckley are producers. And I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. Jim Gately and Ed Maddox are outsiders who come in and do these shows for us on an ad hoc basis. The philosophy is that we are not a personality-driven network, that somebody has to sit there and punch the buttons. As a matter of fact, we've toyed with the idea of putting 2 guests out there and letting them punch their own buttons and see what happens. It'd be a little bit difficult if you hadn't done it before, only because it's kind of intimidating with all the technology. But the objective is just to stay out of the way, that let people talk to the guests, let them hear what the guests have to say. It's not unlike what you do, except that on television, as you know, almost everything that is done has to be personality-driven in order to keep those ratings high. Again, we have no requirement to have high ratings. And so we also want to make sure that our hosts, under no circumstances at any time, although this is very difficult to do, do not portray any kind of bias and just stay out of the way so that the public can make up their own mind about the guests and the callers can talk directly and form their own opinions. And, you know, by the way, sometimes we come off as extraordinarily dull. Understandably so. We know that. But again, that's part of our thing.
That's right. No, but it's true. Listen, people, when people use the word dull in relation to C-SPAN, it's with some amount of praise, you know?
Well, it's, yeah, and you do get tired of, you know, they dare to be dull, but it's an occupational hazard sometimes. Again, though, everybody needs to constantly look at who's paying the bills. And in our case, our industry is paying the bills through the good graces of our cable industry subscribers. They're not requiring us to deliver them eyeballs for advertisers, and that gives us an enormous amount of freedom. And because of that, we can be what we are, and we're not Pollyannas about this.
So I know one of the places you got your start on TV was doing a show called Dance Date, and this was, I think, when you were in college?
It was, and as a matter of fact, just to complete probably a childhood dream of mine, I met Dick Clark 2 weeks ago. The disgusting thing is he looks about 10 years younger than I do. And when I was growing up, I'm 51, when I was growing up, Dick Clark at WFIL in Philadelphia was the most important person in my life. I copied everything he did. I started my own little dance show in Lafayette, Indiana on Channel 18. I built the set, sold the time, hosted the program. And it was really one of the great learning experiences there's not a whole lot of difference between what I do today and what I did then. It's just a different topic of discussion.
Yeah, but it's very subjective to rate records, isn't it?
Yeah. What do you give this? A 95. I like the beat, you know?
Did you do that? Did you do those rate the record
we
things
did,
like Dick Clark?
As I said, Terry, I copied everything that Dick Clark, I think I even tried to sound like him, which is impossible. Everything that he did, I tried to do.
So you played rock and roll?
Everything, yeah. Rock and roll. Remember, we had one camera to do this show. It was a black and white. Gary Henderson, one of the engineers here at NPR, is looking because he knows what I'm talking about, a Vidicon camera, which meant that it wasn't very good. And the way that we had, you know, the way that we were able to do this show was that we photographed on film a record running, you know, on a turntable, and we made a continuous loop so that the director could push the button, and on the screen would come this record. You couldn't see what record it was running around on your screen so that they could move the camera back to show some of the kids dancing in a different position in the studio. So it was as basic an operation as you could ever imagine. So, and that's kind of the way C-SPAN was, I can tell you, in 1979.
Brian Lamb, I've got another blast from the past for you.
Uh-oh.
When you were a senior in high school, I think, you were runner-up in an announcing competition. I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, one of I had a wonderful high school broadcasting teacher by the name of Bill Fraser. He's still alive, very much so. He's 70 years old. He lives in Lafayette. And he, more than any other person, was responsible for teaching me all the little things that you have to learn in this business to get started. And he was the coach of the radio team. And we went to
radio
state.
Team?
Radio team.
did the radio team do?
We went to the state, at regional and then state finals, and you had to announce. You had to read, you know, names like Rimsky-Korsakov and pronounce them correctly. And it was a great disappointment for me. I wanted to win that contest more than anything because I thought radio was my medium, and I still love radio. Went to state at Indianapolis, I came in second, but I lost by 1 point.
Brian Lamb, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry Gross, thank you for inviting me.
Brian Lamb is the founder and CEO of C-SPAN, and you can also often see him on the air. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.